You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Hello, my name is Chris Coyne. I am the Associate Director of the F.A. Hayek Program and a Professor of Economics at George Mason University. And today I am joined by my colleague, Dom Boudreau, who is a Senior Fellow at the Hayek Program and a Professor of Economics at George Mason University. Don, thank you for joining me today.
It's my pleasure, Chris.
So our purpose here is to discuss a new volume that the Mercatus Center just published that I edited. It's called The Legacy of Robert Higgs. It's the third volume in this legacy series we've done. Actually, the first one you edited on Bruce Yandel.
Roger Miners, yeah.
Yep, that's right. And then a second one that Pete Betke and I recently did was on our now retired colleague, Richard Wagner. And this is the third installment of this legacy volume, and or series rather. And the purpose of the series is to reflect upon the research program and intellectual insights of various thinkers, but also to discuss why those ideas continue to remain relevant today. And the legacy of Robert Higgs is focused on the economist and economic historian Bob Higgs. And the structure is an introduction, which is an overview of his life. There's 15 original chapters, of which you contributed one, and you and I will discuss that in a subsequent episode. And then we concluded it with an appendix that includes a list of his publications. And so listeners who are interested in reading that volume will get a great overview of Bob's life, but also his research and a kind of guide if they want to pursue further reading by Bob Higgs. But to start this, I want to ask you to just speak a little bit about your relationship with Bob. I know you've known him a long time personally. You have a very deep understanding of his work. And so give us a sense of your relationship and any thoughts you might have on Bob before we get into the kind of his personal biography.
Yeah, Bob is a dear, close personal friend. I was best man at his wedding 20 years ago. When he married his current wife, Elizabeth, I introduced them, not playing matchmaker, just happened, turned out to be that way. I first met Bob in, I think it was 1987 or 1988, during my first stint at George Mason. He was a speaker at the weekly public choice seminar, and it was a talk on, this is when Bob was doing a lot of work on the military-industrial complex and the public choice aspects of that. I had read Crisis and Leviathan, which had come out just before Bob came to George Mason, and the book blew me away. I'd heard of Bob Higgs. I wasn't quite sure really what he was about. I knew he was an economic historian. And I read Crisis and Leviathan, which was published in 1987, and it's a great, great book. And so I was very pleased to meet Bob. And we just hit it off personally, and so we've stayed in close contact. I do consider him to be one of my dearest friends. I'm honored that he considers me to be a close friend. I was very pleased, Chris, when you asked me to contribute a chapter to that legacy volume in his honor. So I've known Bob for almost 40 years, both professionally and personally. I just think he's one of the most outstanding and accomplished economic historians who ever worked. I was going to say alive, but not just alive, alive and dead. His mastery of 19th century, especially 19th century American political economy and the American economy itself is, I think, certainly unsurpassed. And if it's matched, it's matched by precious few people.
Yeah, and we'll get a little bit more into his work in economic history, to which I would add, of course, and I think you would agree, just as a scholar who has a deep appreciation, but also not just an appreciation, but the ability to apply and leverage the insights, what I think you and I would call Virginia political economy, this mix of kind of political economy in the tradition of Buchanan and others, but also Austrian economics. And it's this blend of things which really makes him quite unique.
Yeah. And, you know, he came by that, you know, not like, now you and I came by it early in our academic careers as undergraduates. Bob came to it only after he got his PhD. He got his PhD in a very conventional, excellent but conventional program at Johns Hopkins in the 1960s. And I think it attests to his open-mindedness, curiosity, and intelligence that he was able to integrate with his conventional mainstream training. There's a lot to be said for that. Able to integrate that training with the best of Austrian economics, of neo-institutional work, public choice. And it's just a beautiful mix. Whenever Bob writes, it's always something worth reading.
Yeah, certainly. So let me step back for a moment and go back to the beginning and walk through a couple kind of key moments or dates in Bob's early life. And then, of course, feel free to chime in along the way. But I'll once I get to his PhD, which you just mentioned, and then first academic job, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that as well, that group of scholars he was entering into out of his graduate work. But Bob was born in 1944 in Oklahoma. And in 1961, when he was 17, he joined the U.S. Coast Guard, which he was only in for a year. But I wanted to mention this because in a 2015 interview, Bob was recollecting his time in the Coast Guard Academy. And I thought this passage was interesting in terms of one of those things that happens to you when you're young, but stays with you and kind of frames your thinking. And in Bob's case, you can see this much later in his academic work, some of which you just mentioned with Christ and Leviathan, and some of which we'll talk about in more detail. But this is Bob Higgs speaking about his time at his 1 year at the Coast Guard Academy. But one of the things I learned there is that in a situation like that, where there are superiors and inferiors in a chain of command, some of the superiors will abuse their power. And I think that is an insight that stuck with me from then on for the rest of my life. You give people power, even petty power, at your own peril. And there are people who enjoy abusing those who can be abused. I think that sensibility was important to me as my political thinking developed, which happened during the 1960s. I didn't fancy myself a libertarian. If anything, when I was in college, I thought of myself as a new leftist, which wasn't all that bad. I was always opposed to the Vietnam War, even when most Americans didn't know it was happening. So that was a big influence on me, too, because that taught me that the government is capable of routinely committing horrible crimes for years on end for even the slightest political motives. And so it's this really interesting context now to look back at his work later in his career and reflect back upon that. But after leaving the Coast Guard, Bob did his undergraduate at San Francisco State College. And then, as you mentioned, he went to Hopkins, John Hopkins University, starting in the fall of 1966. And very conventional degree, as you mentioned, both in terms of theory and empirics. And even if you look at his dissertation title, which was completed in 1968. It's titled Location Theory and the Growth of Cities in the Western Prairie Region, 1870 to 1900. So this was your point about being a master of American economic history. But the fascinating move then is that upon graduation, so we're talking here summer 1968, Bob moves to Seattle to begin his first academic job in the Department of Economics at the University of Washington. And so he joins a department that has future Nobel laureate Douglas North. He has Yoram Barzel, Stephen Chung, Donald Gordon as colleagues. And so can you say a little bit about what was happening both at that department particularly, but just in economics with the rise of new institutional economics, to give everyone a sense?
Yeah, so Doug North, who was the single most famous economist at Washington, he won the Nobel Prize in 1993, shared it, because of his pioneering work in what we call today neo-institutional economics. We call it neo-institutional, of course, to distinguish it from the work of people like Thorsten Veblen and Clarence Ayers, who were completely atheoretical. But the new institutionalists, examine the rules, the formal and informal rules that prevail in society. And they recognize that these rules are both constraints and rewards. And being economists, we recognize that people respond rather predictably to constraints and rewards. So it's not just the institutionalist broadened economics away from looking only at these very direct market phenomena, prices, profits, losses. Those are real, of course, but they're not the only thing. They aren't the only phenomena that constrain and incite human action. The law, the integrity of the courts, the security of private property rights, these all matter. And that, so this new institutionalist research was centered at the University of Washington. It wasn't the only place it was going on, but the neo again comes from its being grounded in excellent economic theory, chiefly then of the sort that was being done at Chicago and UCLA. Bob later brought Austrian insights into it. And so too, in a way, Doug North, late in his career, started citing Hayek a bit more. So you had this neo-institutionalist school grow. Bob tells a story about being interviewed in 1968 or whenever it was at MIT. And whenever he tells a story, I'm always secretly glad, you know, because he's my friend, you know, I said, oh, it's too bad you didn't get the job at MIT. You know, you might have your deserved Nobel Prize by now. But I'm secretly pleased that he didn't get that job at MIT, because I think had he gotten the job at MIT, the chances would be better that he would not have become the great economist that he became. He would have gotten stuck in that mainstream neoclassical MIT mindset. And I think we're better off with the Bob Higgs, who was influenced by Doug North.
Yeah, certainly. So you have the influence of North on the one side. You have, I think Bob says it was reading Human Action that was quite eye-opening for him, to exposing him to Austrian economics and this alternative way of viewing economics as a discipline. But, you know, during this time period, in addition to being, so he's an assistant professor with the superstars in this department, very unique program. And he is amazingly productive, and we don't have time to talk about all his papers. As I mentioned at the beginning, if people look at the volume in the appendix, we have these all listed out, but he's publishing papers in top journals, American Economic Review, Journal of Economic History, Journal of Political Economy, the Review of Economics and Statistics. So these are all taking place during the 70s. In addition, he publishes two books. His first book in 1971 is The Transformation of the American Economy, 1865 to 1914. And the second one is in 1977, so 6 years later, Competition and Coercion, Blacks in the American Economy, 1865 to 1914. And that was published by Cambridge University Press. Do you have any thoughts on either of those books?
Wow, they are just great books. I thought, again, Crisis and Leviathan is the first book I read by Bob, which came out in 1987. And it was only years later that I read another book, rather than collection, full book that Bob had written. And that was Competition and Coercion. I don't remember the year I read it. Jenny Roback, who used to be my colleague here at George Mason, encouraged me to read it. And I was blown away by the scholarship of the book and the thesis of the book. It, in a way, it's sort of a Gary Becker, competition is a good thing and he does away with discrimination, but it's much more subtle than Becker. And he's so good at using lots of empirical data and other facts that are not necessarily quantified quantities and integrating them with theory. And what he shows in Competition and Coercion is that that market forces in the American South, especially in the American South, in the post-Civil War decades, as you said, it's 1865 to 1914, those market forces were minimizing the consequences of racial prejudice. Exercising discrimination in the market is costly. Fortunately, it's costly. And so Bob marshals this evidence showing the consequences of market competition at pushing back at minimizing, reducing the market effects of racial discrimination. Then, of course, we get Jim Crow legislation, which mutes the market effects, allowing, therefore, racial discrimination to take hold and have its effect, because it becomes illegal now in the Jim Crow South to not segregate your buses and not segregate your lunch counters. So it's just a wonderful study of what happened during that very, very exciting period. I think it's an exciting period in the American economy, post-Civil War, you know, the half century following the end of the Civil War. And then I read, a few years after that, the earlier book, The Transformation of the American Economy. And if anything, I think it's an even better book. Bob gets his first book, and Bob refers to it as, I think he once referred, told me, well, that was the work of a babe. You know, he was just young, and wow, I wish as a mature scholar I could write something one quarter as good as The Transformation of the American Economy. It's only about 125 pages, but it is, I think, to this day, the single best survey of what happened in the American economy in the half century following the Civil War, in terms of growth, living standards, institutions in the U.S. economy. And what he shows is not surprising, that it was a period of enormous economic growth, and that that economic growth is owed largely to the openness of the American economy, the openness to immigration, the openness to certainly free trade within this large free trade zone that we call the United States. You know, it wasn't a laissez-faire paradise, of course, but government, certainly compared to today, was then very limited and very restricted. Property rights were secure. And all of that gave rise to this tremendous explosion of wealth creation in America. And nowhere is it better documented than in Bob's little 1971 book. I think it's not in print. It should be in print. And let me just say one more word, Chris, before I turn it back over to you. And this is true not just for these two books that we're talking about now, but for all of Bob's works. Bob is a great writer. He's a great stylist. He's not an obnoxious stylist. A great stylist is someone who writes well, and you don't even think to yourself, oh, this guy writes well. It's just something you want to read. You never stumble over a sentence. You never have it. There's never a doubt about what he means or what he's referring to. He's incredibly careful in his grammar, in his word choice. His style is easy without being ostentatious. There are very few people, much less economists, who write with the clarity that Bob Higgs writes with. And I've said to Bob, and I may have said it even to you, when I write to this day, when I write, there is sitting on my shoulder Bob Higgs. And I know I certainly don't measure up to Bob on that front. But that makes me a better writer than I would otherwise be, because I'd be embarrassed to think that Bob Higgs would read something that I wrote and wince.
Yeah, you and me both. I agree fully. I'm an amazing writer, and you characterized it quite well. And I also hold him up as a model for clarity of thought and clarity of writing. I wanted to mention one more thing on competition and coercion before we move on. And you touched upon this, but you know, people oftentimes hear Gary Becker with discrimination or what you were just talking about the price of discrimination, and they say and kind of the straw man is, oh, okay, they think markets are gonna raise the cost, but you still have these things, you still have racism and people still treat people terribly. And I just want to make very clear, because this is part of, I think, your point about the nuance of competition and coercion, that Bob in this book fully appreciates and recognizes the brutal legacy of slavery. He fully recognizes the existence of race-based coercion and treating people terribly. His motivation in some sense is to understand, well, what can we do about it? What is the best way to insulate people who are, in today's kind of language, marginalized or oppressed? And this is where the markets come in. And so his argument is that, to reiterate what you said, that economic competition played a crucial role in insulating Blacks from race-based coercion that remained after the ratification of the 13th Amendment. And from that standpoint, it's quite powerful both then but now. And I wanted to close this before we transition and go back to that 2015 interview that Bob Higgs did that I mentioned earlier. And this is him summarizing the main insight of the book. And I think it's wonderful because it captures the broad relevance of it. This is Bob speaking now. Economic competition is the salvation of oppressed people, and that you can see that in any case. Pick your ethnic group and you see the same phenomena operating. And so from that standpoint, that's the end of the quote. From that standpoint, that book is both valuable as a very scholarly, nuanced understanding of a historical period, but also, I think, in terms of the ongoing relevance, a masterpiece in explaining how markets provide people with exit options, with opportunities, even when they are constrained on other margins. So it both raises the cost of people doing the oppressing, but also offers people more opportunities compared to less.
Yes, well said. Well said. It's not a Pollyanna story, but it is a story of how markets will, over time, to the extent that they are allowed to operate, whittle away at some of the worst consequences of hatred and racial prejudice, and of course how government is a major avenue for the racists and the bigots to actually get their way by suppressing the market.
Yep, by using the political instrument to block voluntary exchange. So continuing on with our timeline here. 68, he joins University of Washington, extremely productive. You see this both in output, but 1972, he gets tenure, promoted to associate professor. 6 years later, 1978, he becomes full professor. And then he stays there until 1983. And in 1983, he moves to Lafayette College. At Lafayette College, he accepted a chaired professorship. And it's during this time period when he published Crisis on Leviathan, which you mentioned earlier. That's published in 1987. And it is his most well-known book. But I wanted to ask you to the best of your ability, since it's so broad in what it does, but to kind of summarize and maybe touch upon what you see as the main themes and contributions of that very important book.
It's best known for... And I think Bob doesn't mind this. He agrees with this. It's best known for I don't know if he used the term in the book, but it's called the ratchet effect. It's not a full ratchet, but what Bob, again, it's a rich book. It's very difficult to summarize without oversimplifying. Crises emerge, real or imagined. Governments respond always, and they always respond by grabbing more power. And people willingly give government more power because they feel frightened, they feel anxious. We need to do something. We need to do something quick. Well, government's the agency to do something and to do something quick. So government grabs its power. But the power, while some of it may be let go of after the crisis passes, it's never fully let go of. Some of it always remains. Some of the additional power always remains. And so as crises emerge, arise, governments grab power. And then the minimum amount of government power possessed ratchets upward over time, driven largely by responses of government to power. Now, in the book, Bob has a very, very nuanced, fascinating discussion of ideology, the role of ideology. Bob's an economic historian. The book is not an abstract work in theory. He's got many examples that he documents amply, weaving, as he's so skilled at doing, weaving the theory and the facts and the empirical story together to tell a coherent tale. By the end of the book, you realize you're sold. At least I was sold. I think a lot of people who read it are sold. So it's a story about the ratchet effect. And I know, Chris, and you know, and you can add to it. There's so much in that book. It's a longer book than the other two that we've discussed. I first read it in 1987 and reread it, a number of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, and was surprised or disappointed in myself for failing to remember just how subtle that book is and just how many different points he makes beyond the ratchet effect.
Yeah, I agree. It's several readings, I think it takes at least to get the full gist of it conceptually and even empirically, because as you mentioned, he relies in that book on a breadth of evidence, and it's a narrative in nature. So it's quantitative, but quantitative in a verbal manner. So it you have to take it all in, and it's amazing the amount of pieces of evidence from different sources he marshals to kind of triangulate his various points that he's making. To just reiterate a couple points that you made, just to make it clear, I think one of the things I always really liked about it, or still like about it to this day and has influenced my thinking, is the nature of government itself. And in some sense, it goes back to that earlier quote I read from Bob reflecting upon his youth, which is early in that book, he says, look, when most people talk about the size of government, they focus primarily on scale. And the reason they focus on scale is because, as you full know, in economics, we measure, and when you can't measure, you measure anyway. And so what Bob points out is the tendency for most economists or analysts in general is going to be to direct their gaze towards those things we can easily measure: monetary expenditures, number of employees, these type of things. And it's not that those things are unimportant, but one of the really novel contributions in the book, I think, is to define government. He calls it big government with a capital G to differentiate it between just the scale. And the other aspect is scope. And the scope is the range of activities that government undertakes. And this is important in that story, because if you just look at number of employees or budget size, it's possible that you're missing really important things, which is, as you put it, when government ratchets up, it shrinks after the crisis ends, but it never returns back to its baseline level. But of course, Bob points out that, look, perhaps a bureau will shrink or an agency will shrink in terms of number of employees, but that would overlook the fact that they have expanded powers, perhaps, due to the crisis, which can pertain and sustain and expand through time. And that's why the verbal aspect of his narrative is so important, because as he points out, focusing narrowly on standard empirics misses that.
Yeah. And you, what you just said reminds me of another feature of that book, which is very, again, very close to what you just mentioned. Bob also talks about the attitudes of the populace, the people, the population, toward these government actions. When government exercises these additional powers, that conditions ordinary people to become just a little bit more accepting of them. And so it isn't just government grabbing more power. When the next crisis hits, so the government starts from a higher baseline than it did at the previous crisis. But also you have populace whose ideology has been modified by the last crisis, the reaction of the last crisis, to be more accepting of the increase in power that comes with the subsequent crisis. So he's looking at the ideas of the people, he's looking at their mindset, he's looking at the very narrow public choice motivations that operate within government. It's just a masterwork of brilliant scholarship. There's nothing about it that's reductionist in a bad sense. There's nothing about it that, he covers the waterfront, as they say, in understanding all the relevant actors and aspects of what's going on.
Right. And for those who haven't looked at it, just to provide a couple of kind of general topics, and these are big topics. He talks about the Progressive Era. He talks about both world wars. He talks about the Great Depression. And all of these instances of these massive crisis situations are all part of his analysis. As you put it, it's much more than a conceptual or theoretical book, even though if you just stopped at I think it's the third chapter where he lays out the theoretical framework, even that in itself is quite powerful. Again, talking about which is a theme we're highlighting our conversation repeatedly, and it's in the volume as well. It's in itself, it's a valuable contribution for understanding critical episodes in American history. but it also raises an enormous set of fascinating questions for those of us who are interested in these issues today. In addition to providing a general theoretical framework, you know, you get this issue of this crucial question that interdisciplinary scholars have wrestled with for centuries. For scholars you and I respect deeply, people like F.A. Hayek and James Buchanan, they wrestle with this issue, which is, how do you have a government and limit government when it's there's extreme pressure on constitutional rules and a demand for government to do things? You know, I think it's in the third volume of Law, Legislation, and Liberty. This is F.A. Hayek now, where he's talking about the emergency powers of government. And he recognizes this tension. He says something in there. This isn't a direct quote, but something like emergencies are and he has emergencies in scare quotes, by the way, in my reading, to indicate that they might be real or they might be perceived or manufactured. But he says that's always the period when the constitutional constraints are thrown off. And once you throw them off, it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to get them back. And Bob points us towards that. But one final thing I just want to mention on this, you know, one reading of Christ and Leviathan is as kind of pessimistic, that it's very unidirectional. Government's going to keep growing. Crisis is going to happen. And it's at best, maybe it's an issue of rate or speed, which is that the best we can hope for is slow growth. And that might be the case. But the fact, and you touched upon this in your point, the fact that ideology matters, and in Bob's story, the people matter, it provides an opening for analytically and empirically to think about reversal. And one of the things that's often missed in Bob's book is that fact that they view it as unidirectional, and he says in there it can be reversed. I don't know if you have any thoughts or comments on that, but I wanted to mention it.
Yeah, Bob is not a naive public choice scholar. It's not just, okay, interest groups are all that matter and our fate is hopeless because as long as you have concentrated interest groups, it's going to drive everything. His treatment of, I'm glad you brought this up, that's true. His treatment of ideology does indeed allow for a reversal, changing ideas so that it's at least it's possible in reality to reverse some of what government has done. You know, arguably, you might say that some of that happened, some of that reversal happened in the late 1970s and early 1980s with the deregulation movement that got rid of or modified a lot of the progressive era regulations. Yeah, but you know, it is certainly possible. Although, as you and I, Chris, know, because we know Bob personally, he's not the most optimistic person. But as a scholar, he certainly recognize that if ideologies can change in one direction, they can change it in the opposite direction as well. And that's what we have to hope for.
Right. And from that standpoint, he's in a long line, again, of thinkers that you and I deeply respect, Mises, Milton Friedman, Hayek, Buchanan, who all, to varying, Deirdre McCloskey more recently, to all varying degrees, emphasize the importance of ideas and ideology for society in general and understanding society, but also for the hope of some better society, a liberal society of equal and people treated as individuals with dignity.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, knowing Bob, and I think you'll agree with this, I'm sure that's why, that's what drove Bob mostly, you know, not just career advancement, not just the joy of doing scholarship, but the you know, some hope of contributing to, you know, this larger liberal movement that saves society from the illiberalism that's always threatening to, you know, bring us back to savagery.
Yep. Okay, let us move on with the timeline here. So 1983, moves to Lafayette. He's there until 1989. In 1989, he leaves Lafayette and he moves to Seattle University. He's at Seattle for 5 years. And in 1994, he leaves Seattle University and he joins a startup at the time called the Independent Institute. The Independent Institute was relatively young. It had been founded by David Thoreau in 1986. So we're looking here at, it's what, 8 years old at that time. That's why I called it a startup. It's very young. In the 90s, Bob and David Thoreau jointly launched a new journal called The Independent Review, a Journal of Political Economy. Bob was the founding editor. And I'm going to ask you for your thoughts on the journal in a moment. Before doing so, I should mention for disclosure, I'm one of the co-editors now. Bob stepped aside from being the main editor-in-chief in 2013, and I, along with Bob Waples and Mike Munger at the time, took over as co-editors. It's also the first journal I published in graduate school, so I met Bob my first year of graduate school, but I'll save that story for another time. But I want to get any thoughts you have on the Independent Review as a journal.
Oh, it's a great journal, and it's a great journal because of Bob Higgs. David Thoreau had the good sense to give Bob a decent budget and full edit, as far as I know, and full editorial control over that journal. And Bob's judgment about what is good scholarship and what's not is second to none. Pick up any issue of that journal, and every article in it is worth reading. Now, you know, maybe some articles are on topics that might not strike any particular reader's special interests. No one can read everything, but I read it pretty consistently. And Bob didn't care. He didn't care so much about pedigree. He cared about the quality of the argument. So you could be from Podunk U or from Know U, and if you wrote an interesting, well-reasoned, well-documented piece that we could publish in the Independent Review if it was relevant to the subject matter. Yeah, so it's a great review. I am honored that Bob asked me to contribute an essay to the inaugural issue. I think it was September or summer of 1996, I believe it was. The picture of Thomas Jefferson is on the front cover. And you know, I've written for it many times since. It's a great journal. It's readable. It's relevant. And I got to say, Chris, I'm not just saying this because you're my friend and colleague. I think you guys had big shoes to step into when Bob stepped aside as editor, and you've done a fantastic job at keeping the quality of the journal as high as Bob kept it, and as Bob would have kept it had he remained as editor longer.
Well, I deeply appreciate that. I have my own biases, but I'll say this about the journal. I think it's true. You and I know this as academics, and for any academics listening, you know this as well, which is for pick any academic journal. It's not the kind of thing you would pick up and sit down or now I guess on your iPad or your tablet and just read through it like you read a book, and you say, okay, article one, done with that, article two, done with that. I would submit that for almost every issue of the Independent Review, this was when Bob is editing it, and since this is what we've tried to do, going back to your point about trying to maintain his vision, you could actually, if you wanted, read the Independent Review from cover to cover, and you could understand it, and it would hopefully provide you insight, depending on your interest, into a whole host of different topics.
That's a great point. I mean, it is a very readable and interesting journal in a way that you know, the more recognized, celebrated academic journals simply are not. Reading most of those articles in these other journals is like sticking needles in your eyes. Reading the Independent Review is positively enjoyable.
Yep. I want to just read a line from Bob's editorial introductions in the first issue in 1996, because it captures, I think, this point, but also your point earlier about his clarity as a thinker and writer. So this is Bob writing. Whatever the merits of esoteric forms of communication in the various disciplines, my aims as editor dictate that the common language of the journal, as a rule, must be English. I intend to reject the work of writers who cannot express their ideas clearly. Those who write with vigor, wit, and flair will be received with open arms. And he delivered. He delivered. By my count, so he was editor for 17 years. He edited 66 issues. That's over 900 articles, book reviews, which, of course, is another unique feature of the Independent Review, which we've maintained, is there's book reviews, a lot of them per issue. If you just look at the topics, he and David, and then Bob is the editor. As you mentioned, he had full editorial control. He truly created an intellectual space for interdisciplinary scholarship from a variety of perspectives, addressing the most, what I consider to be the most pressing issues in political economy. And so I wanted to make that clear, because it's you know, we tend to focus on the scholarship and teaching of academics, which are quite important, but this entrepreneurship in terms of creating this intellectual space, I think, is quite important as well. Now, here's the next transition point I want to move to with you, which is, okay, Bob's at the Independent Institute. He's working with David Thoreau, getting independent review off the ground. But he doesn't retire as an academic. He is extremely active writing his own work in the 90s. And I want to briefly touch upon two of his most notable papers. And the second one you're going to come back on for another episode to focus on, because it's what your chapter in the book is on. But I still just want to, I want you to give the listener a sense of kind of the key themes or your reactions to each of these articles. The first is in 1992, and it's called Wartime Prosperity, A Reassessment of the U.S. Economy in the 1940s. And the second is his paper on regime uncertainty. That paper was published 5 years later in 1997. It's called Regime Uncertainty, Why the Great Depression Lasted So Long and Why Prosperity Resumed After the War. And so can I get your reaction on wartime prosperity and regime uncertainty?
If forced to identify Bob's most important work, these are it. And as you point out, he does that. He doesn't need to do it. He's not an academic any longer. But he publishes these papers in top economic history journals. This is not stuff, you know, just being written in what is the equivalent of a blog. So, you know, you talk to any random American picked off the street and you say, well, when did the Great Depression end? Oh, well, it ended with the war, World War II. You know, that did it. So Bob looks at the best data, you know, because you have wartime price controls making prices virtually irrelevant as guides as to what was happening during the war. So Bob looks at interest rates. You know, he compares short-term bond rates to long-term bond rates. He looks at polling data. He looks at other sources of data. He surveys a wide range of empirical, not just quantitative. Some of it is, not all of it is. A wide range of empirical sources to measure what happened to Americans, ordinary Americans' prosperity during World War II. And lo and behold, it went down and did not go up. Americans may have felt energized by being part of the war effort. That's a separate story. The condition of the economy during the war was in no way one that could be described as having, it wasn't recovered from the Great Depression. So wartime prosperity is a myth. Of course, a handful of people got rich, a handful of industries thrived. If you're making bombs and selling to the U.S. government, well, you're doing all right. But in terms of living standards, in terms of what people are able to consume, the length of the workday, I think he even had, at one point, he had a measure of the workplace hazards. I can't remember offhand. But by a wide range of different measures, ordinary Americans were not living any better during World War II than they were living during the Great Depression, during the 1930s. And by some measures, they were living worse. And that only came to an end after the war. So this notion that wartime spending, wartime effort, wartime price controls, wartime whatever, got the American economy humming again is utterly destroyed by Bob's research.
Yeah, and I should mention, just to again highlight another theme that you and I have been touching on throughout, these papers are not, the empirical component is crucial to making the point, of course, because he's providing a reassessment of historical episodes. But there's a great deal of nuance in terms of the grounding in theory. And part of what motivates his analysis is that from his perspective, the very framing of the question is off base. And it's off base because, there, to go back to your point about people getting rich from the bombs, a bomb is not a computer. It's not dinner on your family's table. It's not a roof over their head. You know, he has a great line in there where he says something like, look, economics, this isn't a direct quote, but it's close. Economics isn't a science of hammer and nails. It's a science of choice and values. And so whose choice and values count?
Yeah, so just measuring output, measuring GDP, measuring these bombs, measuring these bullets, measuring these machine guns and submarines and torpedoes leads to, you know, really nice GDP figures. But that doesn't, it doesn't put food on the table. It doesn't put fuel in the family car. And of course, this paper has an obvious connection to the other one that you mentioned in our present discussion about the Great Depression and regime uncertainty. So, you know, there are economists have disputed a great deal, and they still do, about what caused the Great Depression, what ended it. My guess is, and I wonder if you would agree with me, I think probably most economists today accept the Friedman-Schwartz notion of the Fed irresponsibly allowing the money supply to contract by one-third in the early 1930s as the spark for the Great Depression. That does not explain, however, why the Depression lasted as long as it did. And to return to the earlier paper, it lasted until 1946. In Bob Hicks' telling. It did not end in 1940 or 1941. It lasted for more than 15 years. And it was an economic calamity. And so why? So Bob, with his regime uncertainty work, that's the question he asks. And again, there's a subtlety here that I am incapable of fully conveying. But Bob's thesis is that there was in the 1930s, particularly beginning in the mid-1930s, just at the time you would think that the Depression would start winding down, you know, would recover from this calamitous collapse of the money supply, Franklin Roosevelt is becoming increasingly hostile to private property, though there is a rise across the world in favorable sentiments for socialism and central planning. Intellectuals are gobbling this stuff up, thinking it's great, and this is the future. Roosevelt is feeding this with his rhetoric. Roosevelt, although he of course didn't actually pack the court, the very fact that he threatened to pack the court in 1937, and the court had its famous switch in time to save nine, as they call it. All of this is leading in the 1930s to great uncertainty about what lay ahead for investors. As regards the security of their property rights, not just whether or not they'd be able to retain ownership. That was a real concern. Is the government going to nationalize X, Y, or Z industry? But will we be able to reap a significant enough portion of the returns from those investments in order to make the investments worthwhile? And so I mentioned earlier Bob's use of comparison of interest rates. That's actually in this paper. And what he found was that the investors starting in the mid-1930s were very fearful of the long run. And so long run investments decline dramatically. And so when investors stay on the sideline because they're fearful of what the regime, they're uncertain about what the regime will bring property rights and institutions wise in the future, you get ongoing stagnation. And so Roosevelt dies in 1945. Truman was simply not the demagogue that Roosevelt had become. And Roosevelt, even in the war, had become a little more friendly toward business because he needed business. He needed to keep them producing some of the things necessary for the war effort. The Republicans, I think I have this fact right, in a surprise outcome of the November 1946 election, the Republicans take both houses of Congress. So we have divided government, and the Republicans, although certainly not perfect, they were more friendly toward business than were the Democrats then. And so by 1946, the regime uncertainty is significantly diminished. We're returning to normal. A lot of the wartime price controls and other controls had been eliminated. The White House is not occupied by someone threatening to whose rhetoric suggested potential threat to the security of private property rights. So we return to a more certain regime favorable toward free markets and private property and the rule of law in 1946 and 1947. And so the Depression ends. Again, that's a summary, but you have to read Bob's work in order to get the subtleties, which are important.
Yeah, that's a great summary because these are quite nuanced papers, each of them. So I appreciate it. You know, as you were speaking, just to link this together, because we're moving towards the end of our conversation, one thing that occurred to me, and you made this point at the beginning of our conversation about, you know, kind of his evolution as a thinker and the influence of Doug North. But these papers in the 90s really, in some sense, capture all the different aspects of Bob in one. So you were just discussing about regime uncertainty, the nature of property rights. That's the institutional aspect. You have a deep appreciation for market process theory. So there's entrepreneurs as an animating actor of markets. There's discovery, there's subjective perceptions about not just the present, but the future, which of course are influenced by these policies. You have government action that is taking place to influence the rules and a focus on these economic outcomes. And so, in some sense, these are wonderful papers and encapsulating all of these different aspects of Bob's kind of different, I don't know if I'd call them nodes of his in the evolution of his thinking, but kind of all these aspects brought into one.
Yeah. Let me just mention real quick. Bob, unlike a lot of scholars, a lot of successful scholars, Bob never was interested in impressing people with being clever. You know, there are a lot of clever arguments. And clever arguments, you know, they have an advantage in getting published. You know, you can explain complex phenomena by pointing, you know, to one surprising foundational fact, allegedly. Bob was never interested in that. I think he's allergic to that way of thinking about the world. All of his arguments are subtle and nuanced without being excessively burdened with extraneous details. It's hard to explain. I mean, he was not a reductionist in a way that a lot of people are. But at the same time, he always recognized that there are, you know, certain fundamental facts, you know, fundamental economic laws, the law of demand, for example, that are always present. And you have to be ever mindful that they are playing a role in whatever phenomena that we're investigating. So he just has a knack for striking the right balance between homing in on the few important explanatory variables without being exceptionally clever by isolating one or two and pretending that it's the only thing that's going on.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you know, one other thing I just thought of while you were speaking that I really like about these papers, but again, it's a theme throughout his work, is he's explaining some historical phenomena in a very nuanced way, that, as you put it nicely. But like a lot of his work, it has relevance so far beyond that historical episode. So wartime economy, okay, he's explaining things during World War II, but think about all the different ways that you can then think about that analysis as it pertains to the war economy in a whole set of different time periods, including the present. Think about regime uncertainty just introducing that concept alone is quite powerful. And as you and I are going to talk in our next episode together, it has a lot of contemporary relevance for understanding the world. So let me close with one more question for you. And it's a broad question, and feel free to go in any direction you want. But how do you see, I started by asking you about your relationship and your views on Bob, and I want to close with a similar type of question, which is, if someone asked you to kind of describe Bob's legacy and his relevance for the world today, both as a intellectual, so from a academic doing scholarship, but also for the world in general, how would you respond to that very admittedly broad question?
Yeah, Bob's a scholar's scholar. You know, Bob always says that about the late Leland Yeager. I think Bob's in the same category. He's humble. He would deny that, but I believe it to be true. Bob cares above all about getting things right. And his legacy, I guess, I'm not sure I can summarize it, Chris, but let me just mention in a different way something I said a moment ago, that in his scholarship, he refuses to compromise. He's not impressed with, he doesn't seek cleverness. He wants to tell a compelling story that is easy enough to grasp without being too simplistic. And just the depth of the scholarship and the thinking, it's just unbelievably impressive. I remember, as I said, the first book I read by Bob was Crisis and Leviathan. And I remember reading that book. And I don't think when I read it, I had met Bob yet. And I just looking at the footnotes, I very explicitly remember thinking to myself, how could one human being read all this and digest it and weave it all into such a compelling story as easily as he does? It's easy to, anybody can put footnotes at the end of a chapter. That's easy to do. What's difficult to do is put a lot of footnotes at the end of the chapter, but have them be relevant. You see the relevance of them in the work in the chapter. He's not just dropping names. He's not just trying to impress the reader with what he read. His ability to digest and integrate different strands of thought into a coherent theory about economic institutions, about the Depression, about the end of the Depression, about wartime prosperity or not, about what happened to the economic condition of American blacks in the post-Civil War era. Too few people have the ability to do that. I don't have the ability to do that. Bob Higgs does. And so the legacy, I think, is in the quality of his scholarship and the integrity of his scholarship.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you for that. I mean, I think that encapsulates so much of him as a thinker and a scholar. And it's a wonderful way to end our conversation, because I think we've provided an overview and we've just scratched the surface of Bob's contributions and some of the key points in his life. And the way we're going to kind of move forward with this series is I'm going to be conducting short interviews. So this is kind of the motivation behind it, short interviews with many of the contributors to the volume. You'll be one of them. We'll talk about regime uncertainty in a subsequent conversation. And I'm going to put them, three of these interviews together in each episode that will be released after this one. And again, each of those is meant to kind of serve as a teaser in a way, so that the listener gets a sense of both Bob's legacy, the work he's done, but also why it's so relevant today. And so I want to thank you, Don, for joining me today, for contributing to the volume. And to the listeners, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. And I hope that you'll check out the volume, The Legacy of Robert Higgs, and listen to the subsequent episodes.
Yeah, and I want to thank you, Chris, for doing the volume and for doing this to honor Bob. You know, I know he appreciates it and will appreciate it. It's a worthy thing to do. So thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. And I will talk with you soon, Don.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason, as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.